Hey everyone, welcome to episode 102 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast. You're right, that is still confusing to say how to...
It's just awkward.
Welcome to episode 102 of the Professional... We'll get this. We'll figure it out at some point in these hundreds. This is Adam. Hey, Jill.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a while since it's just been the two of us doing a podcast.
I'm excited. Yeah.
And just a fair warning to everyone. So, peek behind the curtain. When we do these recordings and it's just you and I, we have two different recording rooms. We usually stay in the same one because it's super awkward to look through glass at each other.
Right.
If it's just the two of us. I have the microphone that can be a little touchy when it comes to sound. And I'm worse at, I'm not good at keeping my face close to this microphone because the other ones are more forgiving with the sound. You're much better at it. I'm taking a chance here. I'm going to try and stay close to the microphone so that it sounds okay. And if it sounds bad, this will be the last time I ever use this microphone.
There you go.
So.
Okay.
What are we talking about today?
We are talking about historical fiction.
Yay. Yeah. And you did some research.
I did.
To find out because it's a tricky, like, not tricky, but it's a...
Difficult to define.
Amalgamous genre.
Yeah. It's one of those things where... classifying something as historical fiction, different people within the field, and I'm taking these from librarians and academics,
right.
Literary criticism type thing, what defines something as historical fiction? Obviously the fiction part we know.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be a couple ways of looking at it. Either it's a book set at a time, like, there's, okay, like 25 or 50, at least 25 or 50 years. Like, I've come across the 25 some places, and I've come across the 50 some places. So, like, a book written at least 25 or 50 years after the events described have happened.
Right.
So, if, like, we were writing something about, like, the 1950s
yeah.
or something like that. But 25 has been thrown around as well, so whatever.
But like, if you and I were to write a book from... And it was based in 2010.
Correct.
That's not historical fiction.
That's not really going to be historical fiction.
Technically.
So there's the looking at it from that perspective of the year. The other thing, however, is having been written by somebody who was not alive at the time of those events and therefore approaches the book writing from a research perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the Historical Novel Society. And then... Jennifer S. Baker in the Reader's Advisory Guide to Historical Fiction phrased it as occurring before the author's memory.
I like all of those descriptions. And as we were joking around beforehand, these are all going to be historical fiction or historical fiction adjacent.
Right.
I promise you they're all books worth reading.
Yes.
Regardless
right.
of the subgenre that they technically fall under. But I think we... got all historicals.
I think so. And I think the other, like, and I was reading something where, so something like Jane Eyre,
mm-hmm.
I would not consider that historical fiction,
right.
but I think some people do. So
I saw some lists that actually that had that on there as well. And then when I looked it up on Overdrive's site, we have it as classic or classical literature.
Right.
And then I started thinking, I wormholed myself last night. I was like, well, wait, what's classical literature?
Yeah.
And I don't want to cover that today.
No, not today.
Like, I don't think I could ever, even if I wrote a genre-defining book, or like, you know, the Great American Novel in 2017, which I'm not working on, guys, don't worry. I'm not. I don't think it would be classic literature, because it's not classic.
Right.
I'm sorry. No,
it's okay. No, but that's like another... None of my books would fit under the, like, Jane Eyre definition of historical
yeah.
fiction. Like, it might be... Yeah. So, mine's all stuff that is either, like, is more written within, like, the last 50 years, but takes place, like...
Right.
Longer than that. So, hopefully... So, this is a very convoluted opening.
I know. But I'm sorry, everyone.
We did not prepare for this, obviously.
Yeah. Jill and I are both super good at doing the research before we come in to record and then terrible at conversing together. Like, before we start recording, here are the things we're going to say in our intro. it's more fun that way.
Okay, so yeah. So historical fiction. We're talking about historical fiction.
Okay, I think you have a few more than me today. So do you want to start?
Yeah, I will say, actually, yeah, I'll start with, I do have probably more. I don't even know, how are we doing this? Are we just going?
I think we'll just do, like, we'll ping pong. We'll go back and forth, okay, like we usually do.
So then I'll start with, all right, so I'll start with, this is not in any order, totally winging it.
And important note, as always, we did not tell each other our lists.
We did not. No, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say, I'm going to guess that a good majority of the women listeners listening to this podcast probably got their historical fiction start with the American Girl series.
I didn't.
From the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved the American Girl series.
Jill, tell us more.
I had a Molly doll. I picked Molly because Molly was the World War II American girl, and my birthday is the day after Veterans Day. This is the logic in my brain. I'm not even kidding you.
No, this is great. I love this. I love this so much.
But there was Felicity, who was in Williamsburg, Virginia. And there was Samantha was Victorian. I can't remember all of them. Kirsten was like, I want to say like 1800s or something. Those were like the four originals. And then they've come out with like Addie was the Civil War. She was just like, or post-Civil War slave or something. And then there's like a whole bunch of them now.
This is also foreign to me.
Yeah. So it was, so there are these dolls. The books are written for, I don't know, like middle grade. I don't know. I don't really do kids books. So, we have other coworkers who do that. That is not my
wheelhouse. All of our librarians have different expertises.
Correct. And I am not the kids books. So there's like six books, at least in the original, with the original four dolls. Well, actually, I guess, anyway, okay. So there were, I think there were six books, and they were, like, all the same. Like, meet Samantha, meet Molly was always the first one where you'd kind of get to know their family and their time period and what their life was like. And they're, like, 10-year-old girls or something like that. And then there was always, like, a school one and, like, a birthday one. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you could buy the doll to go with the books.
That's amazing.
And they came out with, like, all these outfits.
That's good marketing,
and, like, whole set pieces. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty intense. But my friends and I were pretty much obsessed. And that was kind of our foray into historical fiction was the American Girl story.
Okay.
So.
Well, I don't have any, like, when I was really young. As I was looking through all these books, I think the earliest one I read was one from high school. But I'm gonna, as people on Twitter like to say, I'm gonna shoot my shot and provide a very obvious book for me. In fact, one of our friends on Twitter called me out on it and assumed that I was going to
indeed
say this. Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett, which I mentioned numerous times on this podcast because it is. I hate doing, like, favorite things, but this might be my favorite book, full stop, like, ever. So, Pillars of the Earth tells the story of Philip. He's the prior of Kingsbridge. Basically, think of, like, a large collection of monks, and he's the one in charge. And so he gets this idea, and he's driven to build. He wants to build the greatest Gothic cathedral the world has ever seen. And then there's Tom, who is a mason, and he kind of becomes his architect. And he there's just a lot going on in his life as well, and there's this huge struggle between good and evil that will basically turn kind of the church against the state and brother against brother, and it tells full sweeping stories of all these people's lives and their families' lives, and just it's so good. Oh my god, it's so good. It's so good. First off, this book is the reason why I am obsessed with cathedrals and old buildings now, because I read it when I was in high school, and like from the moment I've finished it, I've been planning my European trips that I finally will get to take next year. Oh, it's so, if you haven't read, every time I start talking about it, I gush. If you haven't read Pillars of the Earth, oh my, just do yourself a favor. It's so good. So good. I love it.
Alrighty then.
I love it so much. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So when I was doing research on this topic, one of the quotes I came across was from Nancy Pearl. It was like rock star librarian. She's got like a little action figure, which I think we actually have downstairs.
We do. In our, we have this like big glass timeline case, of Overdrive's history, and she's in there.
We do. We have a Nancy Pearl action figure. So she, in her book, Booklust, says the best historical fiction serves two purposes, to entertain and enlighten, and to inspire readers to search out histories, biographies, and other nonfiction books to learn what's real and what the novelist has imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So people have probably listened to this enough to know that I love Tudor history.
Yes, you do.
And I came across it because of the Other Boleyn Girl.
I purposely didn't read this on the list.
Yeah. So I read The Other Boleyn Girl by Philippa Gregory when it came out, however many years ago, and was just like, this is amazing. And yeah, it did exactly what Nancy Pearl said it was supposed to do. Like, I then went out and read biographies and nonfiction books about the Tudors to find out what the novelist imagined, which was a lot, but that's another issue I have. One of the authors, though, that I came across is Alison Weir. She is a British historian who has dozens of books about not just the Tudors, but other English history, but mostly the Tudors. And then she kind of broke out and now has her own fiction books out about, again, mostly the Tudors.
Yeah, almost entirely, I think.
Yeah, she had one book come out about Eleanor of Aquitaine, but the rest have been, yeah, the rest of her fiction books are the Tudors. And she has a new series out where she's taking each of Henry's six wives and writing a fiction book about each of them.
Did you talk about this before?
Possibly. The Anne Boleyn one comes out in May. If any of our Penguin Random House friends are listening, I would happily read a review copy. I'm just saying.
Hi, guys.
Hi, guys. So, yeah. So, I'm very much looking forward to that because Anne Boleyn's my favorite. And because she's a historian and was for decades before going to fiction, even when she changes stuff, she is very transparent about it in her author's note at the beginning, usually at the end of the book.
Nice.
So, they're well-researched.
Yeah, very nice. My next one is The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead.
Yes.
Was that on your list or no?
It was not. Nice. I almost put it, but no.
All right. Look at us. So if you haven't read it yet, but it sounds familiar, it's because it was everywhere last year. It was the National Book Award winner, number one New York Times bestseller. I believe Oprah put it in her book club.
She did.
Yep, she sure did. But for people who have not read it, first off, super definitely read it. Cora is the main character. She's a slave on a cotton plantation, and as you might imagine, it's a horrible, horrible life for slaves on a plantation. That part is very realistic. And then when another slave who's a recent arrival, his name is Caesar, arrives from Virginia, he tells her all about the Underground Railroad, and they decide that they want to try and escape. And a bunch of things happen, but the part that is completely different than actual fiction, or actual history, it is fiction, the actual history is different because the Underground Railroad is actually an underground railroad. There's engineers and conductors and all sorts of stuff. It is awesome. It's so good. Colson is just an incredible writer. If you're going to be at the American Library Association by any chance this summer, he is one of the headliners. He will be there, but yeah, I don't want to say too much about it because I feel like I'll start giving things away.
It's so good.
It's so good.
I listened to the audiobook, and the narrator was good. Very good. Yeah, she was really good.
Was it one person or was it?
It was one person. Yes.
I didn't listen to the audiobook.
Yes, the audiobook was really good.
Yeah, but it's just, there's so much like action and there's just a lot. It's amazing.
That's actually, so the Underground Railroad is interesting because of that element of it, with the whole actually an Underground Railroad.
Right, yeah.
So it's sort of, I don't want to call it sci-fi, but it's,
I guess,
it's not sci-fi, but it's sort of like reimagined history.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it sci-fi if it was an underground steampunk railroad.
Yeah, that's true.
Sci-fi, which if someone wants to write that,
but it's also not like true historical fiction though, because obviously,
Right, exactly. Although, again, I debated over this back and forth. Overdrive.com has it as historical fiction, and I saw their list.
No, it is historical fiction. I'm not...
But it's, like, it's more adjacent-ish.
Well, yeah, because I think, like, we were talking about this before we started recording, how historical fiction is kind of, like, a big umbrella term, and there are a lot of things that kind of fall into it that can be cross-referenced in other genres. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking about it along the lines of, like, something can be a thriller, a mystery, or a suspense, or it could be a suspense and a mystery, or a suspense and a thriller, and, like, those three are kind of, like, I don't want to say interchangeable, but...
They're not, but they're pretty similar.
But you'll see a lot of books that say that they're in all of those. And a lot of that might honestly be publishers wanting their book to, like, show up in different searches and things like that.
It's possible.
Which is not a bad idea, but...
No. There are actually, like, actual... definitions for those, but that's on this podcast, so
yeah, there's
we won't get into that right now.
There are many other technical,
maybe we will
podcast
another episode, but not this one.
Yes.
You'll
have to bring in some of our very well librarians here who have spent entire lifetimes worth of amazing work. And all right, what's your next book, Jill?
My next book. Okay. So I read a lot of what would be called multiple timeline novels, where like one section is set in the present and then another section is set in the past, and they kind of go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're connected or whatever. So one of the books I read recently was The Dollhouse by Fiona Davis, and part of it is set in the present, and then there's another storyline that takes place at the Barbizon Hotel, which is mostly known as the hotel that Sylvia Plath lived at for, like, a month when she was working in New York City. And, like, that's sort of, like, a running joke throughout mm-hmm. the book, because people would be like, the Sylvia Plath era, and the main character's like, okay, she lived there for, like, a month. This is not... So it was really good, though, and she has another one coming out called The Address, Fiona Davis does, that I think is the same kind of idea, but it's the Dakota
mm-hmm.
Apartment building, which I'm, like, totally obsessed with. So I'm looking for that. Forward to that one.
I have a question. So, and I don't want to undercut your list because I don't know what else is on there, but would the historian kind of fall into that same idea of, like, multiple timeline historical fiction kind of?
But that's, like, totally historical. Yes, it would. Because, well,
there's sort of multiple timelines.
Is it multiple timelines or is it more flashbacks?
I guess. Okay, that was my question, because
that would be different. I mean, that's historical fiction,
right?
On its own.
Is that not on your list?
No.
Nice bonus. Bonus read. We talked about the historian a lot.
Yes. I think that's more flashbacks, not really multiple timelines.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious.
Like, the other one I have for multiple timelines is The Hours by Michael Cunningham, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And that has three timelines, and it's not until the very end that you sort of figure out how they're all connected.
Nice.
Okay.
My next one, and it might be the only one I have that's young adult, but The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this in the books that make me cry as well, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's 1939, Nazi Germany, and then there's a foster girl, her name is Liesel, probably, yeah. She's a foster girl living outside of Munich, and she starts stealing books that she gets from a house that she helps clean and do laundry for, and then her family has a Jewish man come to their house and they have to hide him, and
mm-hmm.
it's very sad, but it's so good. And again, it's YA, so you can get through it really quickly.
Yeah.
Have tissues nearby, because as I mentioned previously, it makes me cry. I've read it, I think, three times. Every time I cry as if it's the first time. So yeah, that I don't want to spend too much time, because I spent a lot of time before, but yeah, The Book Thief, so good. So you may go.
Okay. One of my favorite books. This came out last year. I mentioned it on my On Point interview. Mm-hmm. It was one of my favorite books, 2016.
Humble brag.
Was The Darkness Knows by Cheryl Honningford, which was a 1930s Radioland murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
Her, the next book in the series comes out in October. It's called Homicide for the Holidays. I read an advanced copy. It's so good. I'm like super pumped. Like, it makes me happy. I was like, this is so good.
You didn't just read it. You, like, snatched it out of the box we got from... Is that Sourcebooks? Sorry, our friends
at Sourcebooks. That is Sourcebooks, yeah. Yes.
You, I watched you, like, basically, like, gobble it up from the box. Like, that is mine. That's my arc.
I happened to be walking by Adam's desk when the box is there, and it was you and our coworker Andrea, who's been on the podcast. We're, like, looking through it, and I happened to glance in and see the cover. I knew to look for, like, I knew what the cover looks like. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to take that one.
I have to tell you, so hilariously, in our office, the person who sits in front of me, his name is also Adam. And he saw you walking away with that. And there happened to be two copies of it in my box. Thanks, Sourcebooks. And he was like, is there another copy of that book that Jill just took? And because he wanted to read it as well. So multiple people are reading that advanced reader copy.
It's so good. Yeah. It was so good. It made me happy that it was so good, too. Like, the second one. Because I loved the first one so much, you know?
I'm glad you really enjoyed it. And it did make me laugh because this box... We get a awesome box. Well, we get lots of boxes of books because all of our publishing friends are amazing. But the one from Sourcebooks this month had, like, four different Christmas books in it.
Well...
And I get why.
It's just, like, yeah.
Yeah, and there are books that come out in, like, October.
And so they're...
For the holidays. But
sending them
chuckle.
Out, like, a couple months in advance. I know, it's a little weird.
They'll be here before we know it.
Not talking about that.
I know. I want warm weather before.
We okay.
Okay. My turn?
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about this because if I remember correctly, you've never read it. A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
Correct.
So upsetting. Okay. Everyone on earth pretty much knows the quote. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It's the first line of A Tale of Two Cities. Very few people know anything else about, well, not very few, but not enough people know enough more about A Tale of Two Cities. And it's so, so good. It's set in the backdrop of the French Revolution, and it is this sprawling story of both things happening in London and then in revolutionary Paris. So think, how can I do this? I want to try and describe it without just, like, reading a description for you guys. So in real time, think Les Mis meets less bloody Sweeney Todd.
Okay.
That's not great.
Interesting frame of reference.
I know. Continue. I'm sorry. Think, think a play by, think a play by Oscar Wilde meets Les Mis. Think Les Mis meets something British. Just read it. It's so, so good.
So, like, a British Les Mis?
Yeah, like a British Les Mis, kind of. Yeah, but there's also stuff in Paris as well.
Well, no, okay,
but,
sure.
But, I mean, there's things like, they talk about the storming of the Bastille, there's, you know, death carts with, you know, all sorts of, like, humans in it, and there's guillotines all over. It's literally, like, Charles Dickens takes the French Revolution and just turns it into this awesome, awesome novel. And there's drama, and there's romance, and it's just... There's a prison... There's a daring prison escape at the end. Oh, it's
naturally.
So good. Just take some time. I understand that reading Dickensian English is a little bit different, but read...
It's literally Dickensian English.
It's literally Dickensian English. I love Charles Dickens so much, and it bums me out that not enough people in my life read him. So that's, like, the closest thing I can get from my wife is she'll watch a Muppet Christmas Carol.
I mean, I can't blame her.
I know. I watch it all. Everyone knows my feelings about the Muppets, but, like, it breaks my heart that we have the collective works of Charles Dickens, and she's like, I don't really want to read them. They're hard. And then she'll grab a YA trilogy. I'm like, okay, at least you're reading. Makes me sad.
It's very judgmental, Adam.
I don't know. I read YA all the time, but I want someone to read Charles Dickens with me. I'm gonna pull my foot out of my mouth, and then you can tell us your next one.
Okay. No, actually, I had a story, and I was trying to figure out if I can make it work, and I think I can.
Go. I'm ready.
So, everyone knows, like, I'm a huge Stephen King fan, and my boyfriend had not read any Stephen King until about 2 months ago. So, I understand your pain. And now I'm thinking, I think he wrote, let's see. 11. I'm gonna get the date wrong. 11/22/63. It's a rather well-known date. I should be aware of what it is. 11/22/63, which is what we would call a time slip novel.
There you go.
You made it. Look at that.
See, I was trying to figure out how to make it work.
A little circle.
So 11/22/63, which is the date of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It is a time slip novel because they're basically time travel novel in which, you know, so you have the historical fiction element of going back into the past. So there's that. But that wasn't actually originally on my list until just now. So, I made it work. One of our former big library read books, A Murder in Time, was a time slip novel.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is Time and Again by Jack Finney. It came out in the 1970s. I read it. I had an aunt give it to me probably when I was like 15 or something. But he travels back in time to the late 19th century, New York City, which was kind of fun. Somewhere in Time by Richard Matheson. It was the movie with Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour.
Oh, okay.
That one. Yeah. That... Based on a book, Somewhere in Time, time slip, nice. Going back and forth. Yeah.
I like it.
Me too. Outlander, of course. Is.
Mm-hmm. My next one is The Swans of Fifth Avenue by Melanie Benjamin. I haven't read this, but doing research, I'm going to read it. So it's Melanie Benjamin wrote The Aviator's Wife, if the name sounds familiar. And so The Swans of Fifth Avenue is about this big group of elite kind of socialites in the 1950s, the New York's Swans. And it's all about them and their scandalous headline-making and enthralling friendship between literary legend Truman Capote and peerless socialite Babe Paley. Anything with Truman Capote, I will read, but I'm just going to do a real quick description that we've got here. Of all the glamorous stars of New York high society, none blazes brighter than Babe Paley. Her flawless face regularly graces the pages of Vogue, and she's celebrated and adored for her ineffable style and exquisite taste, especially amongst her friends. By all appearances, Babe has it all: money, beauty, glamour, jewels, etc., etc. But beneath this elegantly composed exterior dwells a passionate woman, a woman desperately longing for true love and connection. Enter Truman Capote, the diminutive, golden-haired genius with a larger-than-life personality, explodes onto the scene, setting Babe and her circle of swans aflutter. Great usage. through Babe, Truman gains an unlikely entry into the enviable lives of Manhattan's elite. And then when Truman's fame is at its peak with such notable celebrities as Frank and Maya Sinatra and Rose Kennedy, all of this kind of converge together on his black and white ball, and all too soon he'll ignite a literary scandal whose repercussions echo through the years. I love all things Truman Capote, so I'm excited to read this.
Sounds good.
And sorry, I know that was a lot of description, but...
That's okay.
Why indeed at all.
The Paris Wife by Paula McLean. Is that on your list?
Nope. But her next novel is...
Okay, so this is about Ernest Hemingway's wife, and it was so incredibly... I don't really know a lot about Ernest Hemingway, and I've read only a little bit of his writing, but it talks sort of about their courtship and wedding, and it's all set in Paris and Europe, and just, it was so good.
I love Ernest Hemingway. I also love Paula McLean. If you are a fan of Paula McLean, or if you are interested in historical fiction, she's a good place to start, because her novel after The Paris Wife is called Circling the Sun, and it's in the 1920s, set in colonial Kenya. It's the story of Beryl Markham. She was a record-setting aviator, and in this story she's caught up in a passionate love triangle with a safari hunter and another woman named Karen Blixen. And if that name sounds familiar, Isaac Dinesen wrote the classic memoir Out of Africa all about her. So, Paula McLean is just awesome. And I think she's from Cleveland.
She is. Let's see. What next do I have on my list? One of my absolute favorite books ever. Shocking, not shocked. Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. As soon as I saw that, I knew, I was like, oh yeah, duh.
Written in the 1930s, said obviously before, during, and after the Civil War in the South. I wrote when I went to college, part of the, I don't even remember, like the English placement exam you took, like during orientation or whatever, to figure out which English class you should be in. I don't remember what the prompt was, but somehow I was able to write about how Gone with the Wind is a parallel to the Great Depression, that like that's sort of where it kind of came from. For Margaret Mitchell was using the setting of, you know, the Civil War and Reconstruction in the South as a commentary on the Great Depression.
Sure. Heck yeah.
Whatever. I got placed into the high English class, so it worked.
Good job.
I mean, obviously, like, that's one of those books you kind of have to, it does not really read very culturally sensitive.
That's
now
a good way of putting it. That's fair.
So, you know, some people can read it, taking into account when it was written. Some people can't.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that obviously had to be on my list.
Yeah. I will say that ages better than some of the movies I like.
I guess that's true.
Like, that, there's just, one of my favorite comedies of all time is Trading Places. And it doesn't age well.
Not
great.
I feel like the movie version of Gone with the Wind is probably worse than the book version.
Yeah, that's fair.
In terms of some of the stuff.
Things they say.
Yeah, that's the way fair. People act. Yeah. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is not the first time Jill's ever talked about Gone with the Wind.
No, it is not. I keep a little Scarlett O'Hara little thing on my desk.
Mm-hmm. I thought sure you would have this and you still might on your list, but Cold Mountain?
I do not. I haven't read Cold Mountain.
Oh, I thought you... So, okay, someone else talked about
it.
Well,
I mentioned it in our myth
episode,
knowing that it was based on the Odyssey.
Right, exactly.
But I haven't actually read it.
Okay, so for those of you who haven't read it, including Joe, it's from Charles Frazier. It was written in 1997, and it was, like, immediately a bestseller. But
Indeed, it was.
This was really the first... I guess, historical fiction novel. That I read this for a history class, and I was like, whoa, this is unbelievable. I believe it won the National Book Award, actually. But basically what happens... how can I describe this? So, a Confederate soldier, his name's Inman, he basically decides to walk back to his home after being badly wounded in a battle at... St. Petersburg, but that's not in America.
No, it's not.
And so then he has, you know, like you said about the Odyssey, he has this long trek through the South as it's kind of falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he has a lot of unique situations. That, again, it's like the Odyssey, but it's set at the backdrop of the Civil War. And if you've never read Cold Mountain, you really should. And this isn't a slight at you. That sounded like one of them.
Fine, whatever.
I know, I'm so sorry. It's really good. Like I said, I read it, I think, twice now since high school.
Okay.
Highly recommend it.
Can't have a podcast without talking about Margaret Atwood, obviously.
That was close.
So, she has a couple, I guess, like, by a couple, like, literally two. I think that would count under this. The first is Alias Grace, which is based on a true story, Canadian, of she was like a housemaid who was convicted of murder of her employer, and there was always a question of whether they think she was innocent or whether she was evil or, you know, insane. And so Margaret Atwood wrote a novel kind of from her perspective. The other one is, which is one of my absolute favorite books, is The Blind Assassin, which is like three stories in one. So there's the main character who's sort of writing from, the book was written in the early 2000s, so I'm probably around that time. So talking about her, she's an elderly lady now, and then it kind of jumps back to the days after World War II when her sister had died, and then like there was this accident and this whole big thing. And then within that, there is a book within a book that had supposedly been her sister's novel. Like, it's so good. So there's like a lot going on.
Yeah.
The first time I read it, I was just kind of, I think that was maybe one of the earliest Margaret Atwood books I read, knowing who she was or like being aware of her and being like, this is just like the most amazing thing ever. And just, I haven't read it in a while, and I kind of want to go back and read it.
Nice. I like it. I'm going to take a second to give a shout out to some of our followers on Twitter, because we got some good responses there. Daryl, who is our good friend, he sent us a couple emails before. He tweets with us a bunch. So, hey, Daryl. He got a couple in here. The Alienist and The Last Kingdom. And then he says, nothing beats Pose of the Earth. Damn right, Daryl. Good job. But I'm going to give you a quick description of the two that he did mention. The Last Kingdom is by Bernard Cornwell, I believe. Yep. And it's kind of like, Overdrive.com describes it as like Game of Thrones, but real. I've read the first one, I think. So it's basically like the making of England in the 9th and 10th centuries. So really, really interesting if you're interested in that kind of time. That's a good one. And then the other one he mentioned was The Alienist, which I had not heard of. It's the first book in the Dr. Laszlo Kreisler series. The year is 1896, the place New York City. On a cold March night, New York Times reporter John Schuyler Moore is summoned to the East River by his friend and former Harvard classmate Dr. Laszlo, a psychologist or alienist. On the unfinished Williams Bridge, they view the horribly mutilated body of an adolescent boy, a prostitute from one of Manhattan's infamous brothels. And then it goes from there. So, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century New York City. That's always a good setting for historical fiction. There's a bunch of those. So
pretty much anything in New York City.
Yeah.
So historical fiction.
So thanks, Daryl. Those are really good. One that I have not read. I thought I did, but reading about it, I didn't remember. The Golem and the Ginny.
No, I didn't read that one.
Okay, so this is a chance meeting between mythical beings, and it takes place on a dazzling journey through turn-of-the-century New York City.
Look at that.
Thank you. Almost like I planned it. So a golem, which is a creature made of clay, and it's something that's kind of, I'm familiar with this because it comes from a Yiddish kind of upbringing. My father's side of the family is Jewish, so I've read a lot about golems. But they're creatures made of clay, and they're brought to life by usually a disgraced or evil rabbi. And they have a lot of magic in them. And then jinnies, or genies. Ahmed is the one in this particular story. And he is a being of fire born in the ancient Syrian desert. Trapped in an old copper flask, he's released in New York City. And then Ahmed and Chava become unlikely friends and soulmates with a mystical connection. That got me, and I'm very interested. So they consider it historical fiction and a magical fable, which, nice blending of two things that I'm a big fan of.
I'm telling you, historical fiction, it's got a lot of overlapping.
Yeah. And that's by Helen Wecker. So,
One of our other Twitter followers, Amanda, she offered Trinity by Leon Uris, which is set in during the Irish potato famine, and follows two families from the Great Famine up until the Easter Rising in 1916. So
interesting,
that one. And then she also gave Count Belisarius by Robert Graves, which takes place in the 6th century. So that's very historical fiction.
Wow, yeah. It's super historical.
Invaders threatened on all fronts, but they grew to respect and fear the name of Belisarius the Emperor. And big historical, very old.
Yeah.
Like, that takes a lot of, I can't even imagine the research process for that kind of thing.
So I'm not trying to be a story topper in any way. This just happens to be the next book that I have.
Yeah.
It's called The First Man in Rome.
Look at
it's
that.
It's part of the Masters of Rome series. It's by Colleen McCullough, and it's set in 110 BC.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. So again, I'm now, it was just, this is happenstance. But basically it is, Rome is becoming Rome, that everyone kind of knows in history. And at the heart of Rome are two exceptional men, Gaius Marius, who's prosperous but lowborn, and then Lucius Cornelius Sulla, who is a handsome young aristocrat. Both of them are extraordinary. They are extraordinary visionaries. They are extremely cunning and ruthless, but they're both outsiders, cursed by insurmountable opposition of powerful and vindictive foes. If they forge an alliance, Marius and Sulla may just defeat their enemies, but only one of them can become the first man in Rome. So, I might like Roman history. So this one I'm into.
Yeah, shocker. I didn't pick up on that at all.
Oh, hush.
Uh-huh. Do you have anything else on your list?
That's it for me.
Okay, me too. Look at that.
Wow, we always Magic. Do this so good, and we literally never plan it.
We don't, that's you guys. Good. Seriously, when we say we don't plan it,
yeah,
we don't plan it. Yeah. Like at all.
That's good, because I have a meeting soon that I have
See,
to go to.
That's good. Worked out well.
Contrary to popular belief, this isn't Jill and I's only job. This is actually...
Not yet, at least. Just kidding.
Yeah, fingers crossed. This is actually secondary to our main jobs at Overdrive. So... Yeah. We get all these people that will get us emails like, you guys are so lucky that you get to spend all your time reading and talking about books. We're like, well, that's not exactly true. That's not what we do. We spend lots of time reading regardless. And then we decided to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because Jill's a genius. We've got a bunch of new listeners over the last couple weeks.
We have.
So we should have led with, if you want to get in contact with us, how can they do that? how can they do that, Jill? How can people both... new and old listeners, get in contact with us.
They can follow us. Oh, I'm not going to be able to do it. Totally threw me off.
I'm sorry. So if you want to...
No! I was going to do that thing that I do where I can't say Twitter.
You just nailed it.
I did that now.
Yeah, sure.
I can't do it. Oh my God, my brain.
Hey, if you want to follow us on Twitter and interact with us, we are at ProBookNerds. And if you want to email us, you can email us at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. We love hearing from people. I guess I think I mentioned this last week, but we got an email from someone who grew up in the same area right around the same time as my father, which I thought was kind of cool. He didn't know that they didn't know each other, but just kind of it was a fun little happenstance.
That Twitter thing won't make sense to any of our new listeners, but it was a thing from like 6 months ago.
Joe couldn't say Twitter.
I couldn't say follow us on Twitter.
Yeah.
I don't know. My brain was just, I could tell my brain was not going to be able to do it.
Well, then it became like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Then it became a self-fulfilling prophecy where I would start laughing because I thought I said Twitter weird.
Yeah, and from long, long ago in the past, Joe and I used to try and plan out our intros very specifically, and we would start giggling, and we'd be like, no, we have to do it again. And to the point where, if you don't go back and listen to our early episodes, but if you are a masochist and want to not be able to hear us very well, you will hear usually just one of us doing an intro because we couldn't get through the whole intro together because we would start laughing.
Pretty much.
Nailed it. So.
Nailed it.
Well, I think that's everything.
Yep.
Right?
Uh-huh.
We talked for a while. We talked longer than I thought we were going to.
Yeah, we did.
So those are historical fiction. Yeah. That's it.
That's it.
Okay.
That's all we got.
Ah, yes. Out like a lamb.
So, yeah, be sure to email us or tweet at us or whatever with any of your favorite historical fiction picks.
And I hope you all enjoyed this episode of the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from Overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.